Hello everybody, this is Peter Laws from the Flicks the Church Forgot. I'm about to review Pet Sematary, the 1989 film, and explore the deeper themes. This is the second part in a multi-part episode which looks at this film. And in part one, that's the previous episode, I reviewed a really great upcoming documentary which is all about Pet Sematary called Unearthed and Untold. So you can check that out as well if you like. The shows are available on YouTube, and I would suggest that perhaps for this upcoming episode, you may want to try out the video version. I say that because this episode features me discussing symbols and images from the film, which I provide through the video, and you may find that helpful to be able to see them as I talk about them. But if you'd rather not, or if you're on the move, you'll just have to sort of imagine what I'm saying. Hopefully, you'll find it interesting nonetheless. So here we go. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube if you're up for that, or follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws. But without further ado, here we go, diving in deep to Pet Sematary. Hi everybody, and welcome back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. My name is Peter Laws. This is the second in a multi-part episode which looks at the Stephen King movie Pet Sematary. There's a great upcoming feature-length documentary about that film called Unearthed and Untold. If you'd like my review of that, then check out episode one of this series. But tonight, I'm going to be spending my time looking more into the film itself and the novel so that we might discuss the deeper themes that Pet Sematary explores. Now, if some of you out there may not know what Pet Sematary is, it's a 1989 film based on the novel by Stephen King, which tells the tale of a young doctor called Lewis Creed who moves into a house just down the path from a very creepy, but kind of cutesy, pet cemetery for local kids to bury their beloved animals in. Only it's sited right next to an ancient Indian burial ground, which happens to have the power to resurrect the dead. And Lewis discovers that in time, the temptation to actually try that ground out becomes a little bit too hard to resist. Now bear in mind that as we discuss the film, I'm going to be sharing some spoilers, some major spoilers of it. So, you know, if you haven't seen the film yet, I suggest you watch it first. But it is difficult to discuss a film like this and its themes without giving away some of the key plot points. But to start with, here's a 1989 TV spot for the movie. I would use the official trailer, but ironically it contains Lalo Schifrin's music from The Amityville Horror, which I just know YouTube algorithms are going to pick up, and I'll end up getting a message saying that I'm breaching copyright for using it. That has happened before when I've used trailers, hence why I'm featuring trailers less and less these days. Hope that explains it for you. But anyway, here's the Pet Sematary TV spot, which admittedly makes the film look like a critty throwaway TV movie, but believe me, it's not. It's more than that.
May the Lord bless you and keep you.
Has anyone ever buried a person up there?
Daddy's gonna do something really bad.
Sometimes daddy's better.
If it doesn't work, I'll just put him back.
Stephen King's Pet Sematary, rated R. Starts Friday, April 21st, at theaters everywhere.
Despite what that trailer might suggest, there was something not only frightening about the film Pet Sematary, but also something that was emotionally draining about it. It were characteristics that really made it stand out from the horror field at the time. The film came out, as I've said, in 1989. It hit UK home video in the November of that year. And to be fair, seeing it on the shelf didn't really prompt a great deal of excitement. The CIC cover art was pretty basic and uninspiring. And this was a year, what you have to understand, when a lot of horror movies were just sort of a bit tedious. 89 did have some good ones there. Brian Usna's Society, which was a very different kind of movie. Also Intruder, which is a fresh and energetic take on the slasher genre. But on the whole, 1989 was a year of Amityville 4, The Evil Escapes, Chud 2, Bud the Chud, and Jason Takes Manhattan. Films that in their own way were fun and cartoony and light, but not particularly threatening or disturbing. And so to anybody in the video store, Pet Sematary and the UK cover art in particular would have seen that and been at risk of blending it in with all the other bland horrors of that year. Except, I suppose, one thing that potentially made it stand out, at least it was, in fact, a Stephen King film with his name emblazoned across the front. Yet even that might have not given horror audiences a great deal of confidence at that time. The 80s had seen a deluge of Stephen King movies, and in the years leading up to 89, he'd had a string of films that were alright, but they felt more cozy than scary. Silver Bullet, Creepshow 2, A Return to Salem's Lot, Stand By Me. Some of these films I actually quite like, particularly Silver Bullet. I've always had a soft spot for that. But Stephen King horror movies were, at the time, being accused of becoming a little bit too vanilla to really frighten. So I rent Pet Sematary and I slotted in, and it did something that not many films did around the time. It actually really genuinely frightened me, and it was scary but also disturbed me. And more than that, it stayed with me emotionally. It sort of buried itself into my subconscious, and I suppose has never really left it. Does that mean Pet Sematary is a perfect movie? No, it's not. Are there flaws in it? Yes, there is. But does it press the right horror buttons in the audience? Well, it did me, and judging by the Unearthed and Untold documentary, it did the same thing for many, many other people. In fact, the film ended up being a big hit. So now, as I get onto the deeper themes of Pet Sematary in a moment, we'll just say some things that work for me about the film. For a start, I think it's a very efficient story with a brilliantly logical structure. Stephen King has a habit of doing this, of coming up with a story idea that can pretty much be explained in one sentence. And it's all you need to know the plot. Telekinetic girl gets bullied, takes revenge. Woman and son trapped in a car by a rabid dog. Man finds reanimating cemetery, tries it out. You know, these are not convoluted story ideas, and so Pet Sematary has this great logic. And how it moves and what it does indeed has a great logic about it. The documentary Unearthed and Untold points out that King based the story on The Monkey's Paw. If you've never read that, you should try it. I first read The Monkey's Paw in some sort of spooky tales library book when I was a kid, and it really freaked me out because it's a masterclass of story structure. Basically, a couple are given a shriveled monkey's paw that can grant wishes, and they try it with horrendous and graveyard disturbing consequences. Pet Sematary really does have that similar sense of a man playing with forces that he lacks the wisdom to control, but also it's like that story, it's slotted into a pleasing structure where one decision leads to another, and then to another, and then to another. It's cool that way. But of course, what makes the film really stand out from others at the time is, I think, the influence of the director. And in this case, she was called Mary Lambert. At the time, she had directed an award-winning erotic thriller called Siesta and a bunch of music videos, and the music videos are an important clue to her style, in that music videos often rely on symbolism and imagery to accentuate the music, tell a story. She made videos for Madonna like a Virgin, a Material Girl, and Like a Prayer, the controversial video. These were really iconic early music videos. So anyway, she hasn't done a great deal since then. She did direct Mega Python versus Gatorade a few years back, but in this, she takes King's script and gives it a wonderful and chilling visual flair. For example, one of the cool things is, like, when Gage comes back from the dead, if you've seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about, he's wearing some very strange funeral clothes, like the baby son of some odd Victorian aristocrat. And it looks crazy and even laughable until you watch it back and see an earlier scene where Rachel Creed discusses her terror at having to deal with her bedridden sister Zelda, who was suffering from crippling spinal meningitis. And you spot that the painting in Zelda's house, in Rachel's old house, is dressed exactly like Gage will be dressed after death, which is really quite strange and unnerving. And not only that, this prophetic little painting also has the cat in it too, though the face looks a bit more like a monkey to me. This portent of things to come is just something Lambert throws in there. Plus, there's also the issue of the face of this child in the painting. Some internet theorists say that this is Zelda as a child before she got the crippling disease, so that basically when Gage comes back from the dead, it's actually the spirit of Zelda who has returned from the grave to get Rachel, which was always her worst fear as a child. That's a pretty creepy idea, although it's hard to imagine that that face on the painting is that of Zelda as a kid. Another theory is suggested by a Reddit user called PROX1MO, Proximo, or something like that. And they say that basically the face in the painting looks a bit like the old woman who sits next to Rachel on the plane in one of the final scenes. Is this the face of something that is coming for her, that is surrounding her in every day, that was even in her childhood home watching her, that has sat with her on journeys all of her life and is coming from the grave to collect her? Spooky. But the fact that Lambert throws all these little details in is a good example of her creativity and her love of symbolism and foreshadowing. She does the same again, actually, with Gage's coffin, and when it gets knocked to the ground in a scuffle at a funeral, which is perhaps one of the most devastating scenes of the film. And we see Gage's coffin, you know, open a touch, and the hand rise up and drop, which, of course, is exactly what is going to happen soon enough. That coffin will not stay shut, and that hand will definitely not stay down. It will lift again. So Lambert was perhaps a risky choice for the studio to take, but I do think that she really does deliver with the film. Another great touch is the music by Elliot Goldenthal. His soundtrack to Pet Sematary sometimes gets unfairly compared to Schifrin's work on the Amityville Horror. As I said, the trailer even uses it. Two horror scores that have sing-song children's choir in them. But the score to Pet Sematary isn't just like a rip-off score at all. It stands on its own with some very frightening writing for strings. Goldenthal had a background in avant-garde music. And he'd write stuff that was both beautiful and primitive and wild. That's what happens here in Pet Sematary. There's some like furious violin playing that really slaps the viewer in the face. Like, whoa, hang on. That's a bit intense. And yes, there's some Bernard Herrmann style psycho music in this as well. But let's, you know, not tell Goldenthal off for that. It's not like Bernard Herrmann, as brilliant as he is, has the intellectual property rights on violently played strings. That's just a technique that we can use. You know, I had the Pet Sematary soundtrack on trusty audio cassette back in the day, and it used to be one of the most popular albums to play when me and my friends would go on ghost hunts at night. By the way, in 2013, it came out in a really excellent expanded edition from La La Land Records, so check that out. Fred Gwynn is the kindly old man. Judd is actually really good in this, and I like how in the documentary we learn that he saw that this film was not just a bleak exploitation movie, but also something important about grief and how we deal with it. This is poignant because in 1963, his son Dylan tragically drowned in the family pool, which of course devastated him and threw him into a depression. Interestingly, it was in the following year that Gwynn was to step into horror, as it were, where he played a friendly monster in a new show called The Munsters. But yes, he does add something pretty special to this film. I also really love the flashback scenes in Pet Sematary. Sometimes flashbacks in movies can be so lame and they take you out of the story, but these ones add to a sense of threat and mythology all around the Pet Sematary. So, you know, the film itself, Pet Sematary, isn't perfect. For example, some of the acting from the two leads, to me, feels a little bit stilted. Not always, but sometimes. I guess I can appreciate some people are a big fan of Victor Pascal, the character, the zombie who wanders around in his shorts chatting to Creed about the burial grounds, and he does a very good job with it. And it's appropriately creepy, but I did sometimes feel like the Pascal character wasn't really essential to the story. In the novel it was great because there was plenty of time, but I don't know, it reminded me a little bit too much of Griffin Dunne's character in American Werewolf in London, the walking corpse that turns up to explain the rules of lycanthropy and werewolf lore. For a film that is so good at efficient story structure, I did wonder sometimes if it would have worked just as well without that. However, I appreciate that's controversial because there's people out there who adore Pascal's character, and it certainly injects spook and gore early in the film, which I guess would be lacking without it. So, you know, I'm in two minds about it. So yeah, the film isn't perfect. However, I get totally baffled by how badly the film was received by some critics at the time. The Washington Post called Pet Sematary bland, cliched, and cheap. Even at one point in that review called it inept. I didn't agree with that review, but I did like the last line of the Washington Post review, which said, "Sometimes red is better. Basically, don't see the film, read the book." I didn't agree with it, but it was still a clever line. Variety said Pet Sematary was undead schlock, dulled by a slasher film mentality. And I suppose what strikes some viewers is the film doesn't just employ gothic spookiness, but it does also throw in a whole bunch of grotesque, exploitative violence. And funnily enough, the film ticks off every form of grief you can think of. Murder, death by disease, accidental death, suicide, all the big ones are featured here. It's like a showcase for mortality. But the film's also about the pain of grief as well as death itself, so I love how the film doesn't shy away from exploring all aspects of that. John Abrams on Chud.com makes a good comment. He says, even those who predicted where the movie is headed may still be shocked to see that it actually goes there. I think that's a good point. Death feels a lot of horror, but some movies explore violence to the body, like slasher movies. Some explore the power of the afterlife, like paranormal movies. Some films explore the pain of grief, like horror dramas, such as Don't Look Now. But Pet Sematary says, let's do it all. Pet Sematary is like a crash course in all the different themes of death, which is precisely why I think it appeals to so many people, because it's like an exploration into something that is important and relevant to you and to me. But its insistence on pushing all the buttons of the death machine means that it is sometimes not liked because of its bleakness. It kills anybody it likes. It doesn't obey the rules of many films, particularly when it comes to the child. For deeper exploration, by the way, of that subject, then check out episode 61 of my podcast, where I explore the taboo of child characters being killed in movies. A cheery subject, but I think a pretty interesting one. Now, this is a taboo that Pet Sematary breaks. One of my subscribers of the YouTube channel, Ed Hill, puts it perfectly when he says, Pet Sematary revels in its bleakness. I think that's a very shrewd way of putting it. Certainly, Stephen King seemed to think so. In 1980, he was interviewed by Rolling Stone, who asked him about the novel he'd just been working on, and it was Pet Sematary, and of it, he said, it's done, but it's put away. I have no plans to publish it in the near future. It's too horrible. It's worse than The Shining or any of the other things. It's just too terrifying. When I first saw this film, I was a teenager. I had no kids and no concept or thought of having kids myself. So watching the film was frightening and scary on a particular level. But seeing Pet Sematary again as an adult father now, I was surprised at how much deeper the feelings were about it. I don't want to suggest that you have to have a kid to have empathy for parents on screen. I think that's a bit patronizing to say that, but what I am saying is I personally have noticed a difference in me, that before I didn't have that much empathy for these sorts of situations. It was all right, but now I feel like I have. I've got a four-year-old son, not much more older than Gage in the film, and at one point in the documentary they mention how they achieved the special effect of Gage being in the road in the path of an oncoming truck. They used a huge mirror, basically. And I thought, wow, what a cool theatrical technique. I'll check that out. And so I decided to watch just that scene, just to see how effective that special effect was. And it was the first time I'd seen Pet Sematary as a parent. And you know what happened? I saw the kid running into the road, and my brain just said, don't watch this. I switched it off. It just pressed in on a part of me that wasn't there when I was 14. Again, I'm not saying that I won't watch the film again, far from it, quite happily, but at the time, well, it was after midnight, my brain was just simply saying to me, don't put that image in your head before you go to bed, and don't see the funeral scene that really freaked me out as a kid, because now it would challenge me in a new and more intense way, for me personally anyway. But rather than me sit here now and say, so really, on retrospect, I think they should have toned Pet Sematary down, I am the absolute opposite. I'm hats off to a film that treats death and grief with respect and appreciates how crap and horrible it is and how it can hollow you out. Remember, this was the 1980s. This was the era of the A-Team, smashing cars off cliffs and everyone being fine afterwards. A year or two earlier, Stephen King had an adaptation of The Running Man, which came out, which had Schwarzenegger doing the usual thing of being indestructible and blowing people up with wisecracks and there being no sense of loss at the characters dying on screen. Fine, that's the type of movies that they were. But Pet Sematary comes along and says, hang on a minute, death isn't something to laugh at, or that we can smack down with a big enough gun. It's real, and our dealing with it is real too. Because we all have this connection with other people, and when it's severed, we struggle to know how to be. I think this shot in particular gets to me, this picture of Creed carrying his son around in a backpack. It's such a normal and mundane image. In films, the hero isn't often pictured in such a domestic and average-looking position as Creed is here. And when I saw this image as a teenager, this picture barely registered to me. But these days, I look at this shot and I instantly picture myself. I've got a daughter a few years older than my son. I've got the same setup as those guys have. I carried my son around not in a backpack, but walking around with him up here. And I love there's a sense of mundane beauty in this picture, which says, oh, this is just what family life is like. These are like my Saturdays, as it were. But this shot is also a creepy reminder that the time in the film is coming when Creed won't see his son Gage anymore. Gage will not be in his eyeline anymore, and it will be gone, and it will be weighing on him and creeping up on his back, and it will be heavy. You could say that this picture sums up the gentle image of the dead never really leave us, you know, that we carry around with them, and this is could be a comforting shot. And I suppose it could be, yeah. But in the world of Pet Sematary, it's saying, no, this isn't comforting. The dead are coming for you with aggression. This will never let you go. Perhaps one could even say that the people we love are like the proverbial monkey on the back, the drug we can't quit. Ditching drugs and going cold turkey is devastating, and in a similar way, when you lose someone you love, it's very much like that. We suddenly realize how addicted we were to their presence. And nothing wrong with that. But without it, we go into meltdown. So that if there was ever a chance of getting that drug back, that companionship back, we would take it. Enter the Micmac burial grounds. So the original movie and the novel is, in one sense, about death. Yet it's also a film that says we feel most human and most alive when we are with the people that we love. And when they're gone, we are shadows of ourselves. I think that's the clever irony of the documentary, which I reviewed in the last episode, because it ends up being a celebration of the very same thing. It's a celebration of the power of community, the power of working together to create something new, of being together, but also the simple need we have of other people, that God, or however you would want to view it, has made us not to function well in isolation, that we have a kind of special connection with other people around us. So this documentary is a celebration of that sense of community to come together to make a film. But the original film is a chilling exploration of what happens when that community is taken away. You know, taken together, I think they make a fascinating dual view of the wrongness of death and losing one another, and the rightness of life, and finding one another while we still can. But as well as being a film about death, there are some other themes I think that we can draw out of Pet Sematary. As an Englishman, it's always interesting to me to see horror films that explore the latent sense of American guilt concerning the Native Americans. There's a few obvious, I guess, significant horror movies that use the tainted Indian burial ground as a source of bad things, as well as Pet Sematary. The Poltergeist and the Amityville Horror are the two examples that immediately come to my mind, at least. And one can read this angle in two ways. In one sense, this Indian burial ground haunting thing is a feeling of subconscious guilt that the Americans have pretty much removed or buried an entire people group, and so the spirits of those slighted ones will return to seek vengeance. So it's a kind of guilt narrative, that makes sense. But the other explanation of why Indian burial grounds would be a source of horror is rather more sinister. And that is that the spirituality of the Native Americans is seen as somehow dangerous and sour compared to the clean, upstanding faith of the Christians. Like the Pet Sematary of the film, it's a strange, you know, like that Pet Sematary is a strange but sweet place for people to pass their loved ones on to the next. But the Indian version of it screws that up and turns people into monsters. That's the bad one. And I rather suspect that the Native American spirituality trope in horror is a combination of these two things. A feeling of guilt of that people were forced out, but also that fear of cultures that are different to our own. I was looking into this Micmac burial ground stuff the other day, and I found a forum where Pet Sematary was being discussed. And someone had asked on that forum why the burial ground turned animals and people evil. And there was a reply from a poster who called Listener, and he said this: "'Cause Stephen King's such a friggin' genius, he doesn't have to make sense. Plus, hello, what part of ancient Indian burial ground don't you understand? I mean, does the word duh mean anything to you? Jeez, people, some things are just obvious, and some things are just obvious.'" His answer did make me laugh, but it's still a pretty telling one. Basically, the assumption is that it's Indian and spiritual, so obviously it will be a destructive force. Couldn't have any positivity to it. That's an insight into how one culture can get afraid and incredulous toward another. For Christians, their faith can make perfect sense to them, but other faiths can sound exotic and strange or nonsensical or even dangerous. It reminds me of the stand-up comedian Bill Burr. In his Netflix film, I'm Sorry You Feel That Way, he makes a pretty amusing point when he talks about how he used to see other religions as utterly ridiculous. He was a Christian back in the day. but he would see Scientologists being like into aliens and stuff, and he'd be like, wow, that makes no sense. And yet his own Christian faith at the time felt so rational, even though when you stop to think about it, Christianity itself is pretty out there too. It's just we have that tendency to view other belief systems as not just different, but as make less sense or even be threatening and frightening. You see this in The Exorcist, which opens with the Muslim call to prayer. I remember as a kid being really scared by the man singing because it was in a different foreign language I couldn't understand, and I just didn't get it. I was, what is this? What's he saying? Or for example, I was listening to the soundtrack to The Last Temptation of Christ by Peter Gabriel once, and that employs a lot of world music influence and voices, and someone heard me listening to that music with its foreign sounding voices, and they suggested that I turned it off because it sounded dodgy. You know, like as a Christian, I shouldn't be listening to that. As if Middle Eastern sounding language can't possibly be Christian, which is so ironic when you think about it, when you think about the origins of where Christianity came from. I mean, in the last set of episodes, I talked about mutant bodies in horror and the fear we have of those who look physically different to us. But in Pet Sematary and Poltergeist and The Amityville Horror and others, in some ways, I think these films sort of like play on a different theme of fear. The fear of those that have different religious systems to us, basically. Indeed, for some people in the Western world, Christianity itself is becoming a good source of horror because more and more of us feel separated from it, and therefore it feels foreign enough to be frightening. But despite this point about ancient Indian guilt and prejudice, the film Pet Sematary is still at its heart about death. Stephen King commented on this in the introduction to an edition of the novel that came out in 2000. And he said, I'm particularly uneasy about the book's most resonant line, spoken by Lewis Creed's elderly neighbor, Judd. Sometimes, Judd says, dead is better. And I hope with all my heart that this is not true, says King. And yet within the context of Pet Sematary, it seems to be. Funnily enough, that line from Judd reminds me of a friend I once knew, a Christian, who actually had a fundamental fear of something many believers rejoice in. He hated the idea of eternal life. He feared it. He said he loved having faith in God and the idea of a companion and guide here on earth was cool, but he was much more comforted by the idea or the hope that when he died, it was the end of everything. He thought the thought that like he would go on and furthermore go on into infinity, that was too terrifying for him to imagine. Now, I had a talk recently at an event in a Costa Coffee shop here in my town, and I chatted with an atheist there afterwards who shared the fears of my Christian friend. Both of them thought surviving death in some form scared them. They felt, in short, that dead really is better. I understand their fear and I respect their view, but I suppose I'm a little bit more like King in that I hope that dead is not better, unless I'm living in the world of Pet Sematary, where life before death is pure and good, yet life after is aggressive, twisted, and psychotic. These bodies come back and they're bent on evil, in which case dead really is better. This theme is taken up in Stephen King's recent novel Revival, which certainly paints death as an incredibly bleak and undesirable state. I'm not surprised that King also found that novel frightening, because that book really does touch on the same fears that fuel Pet Sematary, the idea that heaven and a better life after death is in some ways a sort of naive fallacy. And then instead we all face not oblivion, but conscious bleakness after our heart stop. Another way of explaining why the bodies of Pet Sematary come back as evil could be through the approach that Wes Craven took on his mid-1980s TV film, Chiller. It was a bit of a silly little film, but it's all right, where a business executive, Miles Creighton, dies and gets cryogenically buried and preserved, and the hope is that he'll be revived at a later date when medicine's advanced enough to operate on his ailment. Sort of put a pause button until science catches up approach, which is an intriguing idea that used to be in for a while. Anyway, Craven has him thawed out and he's walking and looking normal and healthy, only there's something morally wrong with him. He isn't quite right. In fact, he ends up being downright homicidal because, as the film points out, he lacks a soul. That was what made him good. Now, is that why the dead in Pet Sematary are evil? Because their spiritual soul has gone off into heaven and we're left with an essentially evil and instinct-hungry flesh and no more? Well, I'm a fan of the late Wes Craven, but I'd suggest that this binary flesh is bad, soul is good thing It's an example of a common misconception about life after death, which is both outside and inside the church. There's a few, among lots of people, whether they're religious or not, that our bodies after our death will be spiritual, and that our physical bodies, this stuff, will just be discarded. However, the Bible and the early church do tend to teach something a bit different from that. They point out that the original creation was good, and so God wants to get it back to how it was and redeem it rather than just ditch it and put it out of the way. However, as history went on, the ancient Gnostics denied this idea, and then Plato's followers did the same. The basically Platonic ideas started to influence culture in the church, which said, and they still influence us today, that said, the body is evil. And it traps the soul, so we really should get rid of it. But the soul is the immortal core of humanity, but the physical world's an illusion. It's not good, it's sort of polluted. Let's ditch it, let's get rid of it. With these Platonic ideas in our psyche, some Christians today are suspicious of the body. They get hung up on sex because it's of the flesh, which is somehow bad. Even though God declared it good in the beginning, but we feel it's the soul that makes the flesh good. Can you see how Wes Craven or certain readings of Pet Sematary can use this idea to explain why the resurrected bodies are bad because they lack the spiritual element? But also it can lead to some Christians thinking not cool thoughts that basically we're on a mission to ditch this world, both our world and our bodies. Hence we have theology that say, you know, Jesus is coming back and we just got to wait, hang on till that happens, and we'll vanish with him from this planet and we'll meet him in the sky in the rapture and head off to some new place as spiritual beings. This can lead to some Christians seeing no value in environmental issues, for example, because this world is just an old rock which we're going to ditch in favor of the spiritual mansion we will be given in the sky. But various scholars argue that this escape theology isn't that biblical. The idea of us going to meet Jesus in the sky, they argue, is not so much us leaving the planet, but it's us going out to meet a king to escort him back to his palace, i.e. the renewed heavens and earth. So the Christian hope is not necessarily that our bodies will be worthless after death, but rather that our bodies will be the centerpiece of our renewal. N.T. Wright puts it this way: we sometimes say that after death we might become a shadow of our former selves, but like Gage's in the film, a dark version of who he was. But actually the Christian hope says that we are now a shadow of our future selves, and that we will become more fully who we are after death, not just spiritually, but physically, manifested in flesh. In that case, dead really is better. You know, to conclude, let me just say that a quick word about the novel Pet Sematary. Before I saw the film, I did read the novel a few years before, and I recall it being one of the creepiest King novels I'd read. Still to this day, I vividly remember sitting on my windowsill way after my parents had told me I should go to sleep, and I was reading Pet Sematary by the glow of the street lamp outside. And I used to read a lot of horror and spooky books like that, and I have this really clear memory of reading the part where Dr. Creed has just buried his dead cat in a plastic bag up at the cemetery, or rather just beyond it. And the next day, I think it is, the cat returns. Only it seems to be acting a little different, you know, what's wrong with it? And there's this one detail. Creed notices something snagged in the cat's teeth, and as he looks closer, he spots the sliver of plastic from the bag he buried it in. Oh my word, I remember when I read that, I can vividly remember myself going, and then looking around, I'm just getting, suddenly being reminded of the power of horror, but the power of novels and writing to really get into your head and stay. Pet Sematary is both a novel and a film that has managed to do that, I think. Well, while various critics write it off as bland and cliche and inept, there were millions of others, including myself, which saw it as anything but. Perhaps that was because of its excellent story structure, or its spooky imagery, and its foreshadowing, or its great music, or its relentless and fearless approach to the subject matter, or perhaps it's simply because it's one of the few horror films of the time that was willing to say, hey, death is real, maybe we should think about that a bit. It's funny how a little VHS box on a shelf, or a DVD or a Blu-ray, or a stream on Netflix or wherever, can be a 90-minute portal into the very heart of what it means to be human. Pet Sematary, flaws and all, is a great example of how the themes of horror are often the most profound. Well, that's it for the Flicks the Church Forgot. Thank you for listening. Please share and subscribe on YouTube and follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws or visit the website, the Flicks the Church Forgot. Also, you can also read my column in the Fortune Times magazine. But until next time, enjoy horror, but embrace life. And don't forget, the Flicks the Church Forgot.